Kutztown Couriers, LLC, a local bicycle food delivery company delivering to the Portland metro area in an hour or less. More information and a list of local eateries they work with can be found at pdxccc.com.
You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM, K296 FT West Haven serving Portland at 107.1 FM, and K219KU Nehalem serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 FM. Streaming live and archived at xray.fm. Radio is yours.
Service Daily Newscast for October 20th, 2025. I'm Joe Mallory. The federal shutdown is nearing 4 weeks with no end in sight. Both parties face political pressure, but health care has become the focus. The New York Times reports Democrats refuse to pass a spending deal unless Republicans extend Affordable Care Act tax credits. That stance has split the GOP. Some Republicans want to repeal Obamacare, while others warn doing so could backfire politically. President Trump hasn't outlined a clear path. For now, both parties are standing firm as the shutdown deepens and voters grow frustrated. An Illinois-based union president is speaking out about how that shutdown is impacting federal employees outside of Washington and says lawmakers must learn from the historic 2019 shutdown that dragged on for 35 days.
Brent Barron is the president of the National Council of Field Labor Locals under the American Federation of Government Employees, a union which represents 7,500 employees at the Department of Labor. He says since October 1st, about 75% of Labor Department employees have been furloughed. About 3,000 employees are still required to work without pay, and Barron explains they can't file for unemployment because they are technically still employed.
Your everyday expenses of going to work continue. Putting gas in your car, preparing lunch, putting your kids in daycare, all the other things that go with living, they keep going on. But guess what doesn't go on? A paycheck.
Barron, who's been a federal employee since 1989, says during the 2019 government shutdown, people couldn't afford to keep coming into work despite management requiring it. He says that could happen again. The union is providing resources for members on its website, and Barron is encouraging all furloughed employees who can file for unemployment to do so immediately. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
Three West Virginia jails holding detainees arrested by ICE are over capacity. Data from the state's Corrections Division shows the Northern Regional Jail in Moundsville, the South Central Regional Jail in Charleston, and the Eastern Regional Jail in Martinsburg were all holding more people than permitted. Lawmakers, including Democratic West Virginia Delegate Hollis Lewis of Charleston, say the state should be pursuing alternatives to detention to ease the strain on jails.
A lot of individuals are sitting in those facilities because they are suffering mental health issues, and we don't have proper wraparound services.
In the last decade, West Virginia's jails were the deadliest in the country, compounded by overcrowding problems and staffing shortages. This is Public News Service. As ratepayers across Maryland face steeper electrical bills, consumer advocates are offering advice on how to lower your energy costs. More from Zamon Perez.
A new guide from the Maryland Energy Advocates Coalition outlines six steps to combat rapidly increasing prices. The first step is to get to know your utility bill. From there, the guide recommends that homeowners take advantage of a free energy checkup and HVAC tune-up offered through Maryland's Empower Energy Efficiency Program. Laurel Peltier, the chair of the coalition, wrote the guide. She says consumers have started feeling the crunch with their energy bills.
Energy was cheap for a long time, and so we didn't really care. You know, it's like you kind of got your utility bill and it was like, you know, this is affordable. And for low-income families, they were struggling before. Now they're underwater.
Energy costs have jumped across the country almost twice as fast as the overall cost of living.
A Detroit high school that offers special instruction on flying or fixing airplanes and drones has reversed high absenteeism rates linked to transportation barriers.
When searching for solutions, Principal Michelle Davis remembered how she felt as a child when her mother purchased a Huffy bike, and she wanted her students to have the same excitement. A phone call to the school's advisory council and a partnership with the Mitch Albom Foundation, Davis explains, set the plan in motion to surprise almost 100 kids with their own bikes.
It was like Christmas. They were screaming and yelling, clapping. Some of the kids had never had bikes before.
Chronic absenteeism rates have dropped by 14%, Davis adds, and a culture shift has taken place since the program's start. Students feel empowered because they have transportation at their fingertips, and some mobility issues are removed when parents' work schedules and students' extracurricular activity times are not compatible. I'm Terry D. reporting.
A developer is slated to build a massive AI data center in New Mexico after only a few weeks' notice to local residents. And opponents say it's created distrust about the process.
Developers behind the $165 billion Project Jupiter have pledged to create 2,500 construction jobs and 750 full-time positions. That may be good news for the economy, But critics worry the project could strain the region's water and power resources and cause significant pollution. Joe Cardillo is with the advocacy group Progress Now New Mexico.
Private companies are not coming into local communities because they want to do good. They're coming to make money. And 3 weeks is certainly not enough time for the community to have a real transparent conversation about the costs and benefits.
Cardillo says the lack of transparency has led many to conclude it was a done deal before the public hearing was ever held. I'm Roz Brown.
This is Joe Ullery for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week.
Humankind is based on the creative efforts of the people who came before us and will continue to be so, right? So we really do have to continue to nurture creativity, whether it's in the arts or writing or science.
I'm Suki Wessling of The Babblery, where we try to make sense of our modern Tower of Babel. Today on Sprouts, we approach creativity from two directions.
I think we have to look at what does the experience of making art and writing give us? What do we get from that encounter? I do see it as an encounter. It's an encounter with ourselves, but it's also an encounter with what Jung called the collective unconscious.
Patrice Vecchione is a writer, artist, and teacher who has worked with children and adults, helping them learn to stoke their curiosity and creativity through poetry and visual arts.
I am interested in all things having to do with learning and development and children's well-being. I try to live in ways wherein I encourage people's creativity and motivation and understanding of the importance of living every day as if it's the most important thing you can do to learn and engage with others and to find different ways of enjoying all that we have around us.
Joanne Foster started as a teacher who became fascinated by creativity, what it is, and how we can develop more of it. She researches and writes books on creativity in education. I interviewed Joanne and Patrice separately, and I love how their perspectives came from two different directions, but arrive in the creative middle. So let's start with the obvious. What is creativity?
People have this sense of confusion that creativity is just something that barrels out of you or is ignited in some mysterious way. I like to think of creativity as a superpower, as a way of taking hold of the possibility to see things, to meet challenges, to resolve issues in ways that we might not have thought of before. So creativity is actually enabling. It enables new pathways. It enables comfort. It sparks excitement and joy and wonder and anticipation.
That was Joanne, who has developed practical tools for the classroom to ignite children's creativity. But Patrice, the artist, sees it differently.
Joanne Foster, she said, people think of creativity as mysterious, but it's not. I do find it mysterious. And I like that I find it mysterious. I agree. She also says that creativity is a superpower, a way of taking hold of the possibility to see things we might not have thought of before. Yes, absolutely. That I completely agree. That is what creativity is. But to me, there's a quality about it that is beyond rational understanding. It, for me, is it's a spiritual thing. It connects me to the earth, connects me to other, when I'm teaching, to other people. It is the impulse to create unexpected change. I think that I've never thought that before. I've never, certainly never said it. But I think that is what it is, the impulse to make unexpected change, change that you couldn't have foreseen from the outside. So for me, there's an inside and an outside.
And it leads to a greater sense of accomplishment, being able to think in fresh ways, building upon our intellect, enhancing our neural connections actually as well. If you think of your brain as millions and millions of pathways of sort of tangled vines going every which way, then think of having bursts of sparks and these are called synapses actually, absolutely everywhere, flashing every millisecond. That's sort of creativity in action, and we can harness that. We can use that.
What Joanne is referring to here is that despite the popular conception of right-brained and left-brained thinking, creativity is not centered in one part of the brain. Scans of creative brains at work show that creativity is a combination of the problem-solving strength of the prefrontal cortex, the emotional strength of the limbic system, and the spatial orientation and visualization abilities of the parietal and occipital lobes. In other words, just as Joanne said, a creative brain is firing in all directions.
Creativity is the opposite of boring. It's an energy, it's a force that exists, and we can dip into it or we can refrain from it. My experience of creativity grew exponentially after I met my husband and we moved in together. And because I felt such a sense of being cared for, being cared about, being supported, it gave me rein to be daring. And that's another quality about creativity, is it's an experience of being daring, because you often put together two unlike things and you see what happens when they sit together in a poem, in a piece of art.
There are a lot of people who think wrongly that they aren't creative.
Creativity is always available if you want to use it. Just think of it sort of tucked in there in your pocket or inside your brain or wherever it is that you tuck your special moments, and think about how you can actualize it. So for a very young child, creativity would look very different than it would for an older person. And people express their creativity in different ways. It might be through gardening or through art or through writing poetry or through gymnastics or baking or making music or doing sculptures.
My favorite thing about writing, and in particular writing, making art too, is the element of surprise, which connects to the idea of coincidence. That when I sit down, no matter what I think I might be writing, it's never only that. Either it completely changes, or something else comes in that I couldn't have foreseen.
Highly creative people might not even know how they're doing it. They might think they're just following instinct. But Joanne's research shows that people who want to increase their creativity can consider two ways of looking at it.
Creativity involves stretching ourselves in new and imaginative ways. So we might want to do that convergently, that is, by narrowing possibilities and then focusing into something really specific. We may want to do it by thinking divergently, which means that you have lots of different ideas all sort of floating around there, and you have to wean out the ones that are most appealing to you or that you think have the most value with respect to extending your creativity. So you've got convergently, you've got divergently, and then you might want to think critically too when you're trying to be creative, because you want to at some point become more disciplined around your ideas and maybe analyze them and think further about them and figure out what to do with them. To take them to the next level. And creativity develops step by step. Sometimes we have to master challenges along the way. We run into a roadblock or a distraction or something that takes us off track. And creativity requires effort. It means you have to sort of work at it. You have to put forth that effort in order for it to move forward. It's not something that necessarily just ignites. Mm-hmm. Although sometimes we do have spontaneous flashbulb type moments, but it also often occurs over time and with effort and requires us to really think it through and be patient.
One major way that people stifle their creativity is through risk aversion. From childhood, many of us are conditioned to avoid risk-taking, especially when taking a risk will separate us from the herd. The thing is, practicing your creativity literally does separate you from the non-creative herd. Let's hear Patrice and then Joanne talk about risk.
Foster says creative ideas are often born when you're taking a risk, doing something outside of the norm. And I think that's extremely accurate and extremely important that in the creative act, there is an element of stepping into unknown territory. And to me, that's part of why it feels mysterious, because I don't know, it's the risk. I don't know where I'm going. And that is a kind of fuel. You know, it's like you think of the adventurers, the people who climb mountains. You know, that's about as close to climbing a mountain as I'm ever going to get is writing a poem, you know.
I love that idea about practicing your creativity. It means that you're stretching yourself. You're taking a risk. You're doing something outside the norm. And a lot of creative ideas are born that way simply because you break free of that rut, that same old way of doing. And you feel really good about it afterwards because you feel, hey, I've done something cool here. I've achieved something that maybe I hadn't anticipated doing.
Patrice points out that for today's teens, risk-taking has a whole different meaning than it used to have.
I was just in some high school classes yesterday, and the students there gave me great attention when I was reading poems and talking to them. And they wrote up a storm, but they refused to share. As much as creativity needs risk, creativity also needs safety. And when the students don't feel safe because they're concerned about social media implications and bullying, they will not share out loud. But when they let me see what they've written, the writing is strong.
What hobbles people's creativity? Patrice has seen a huge change in her years of teaching in schools. Here she talks about a book of poems written by high school students. In one poem, the writer, a teen girl, says, "More often it is a tape measure hugging my waist rather than hands."
And so the pressure that teens are under right now, especially girls in relation to their bodies, is, and this girl, when she came to the reading, you know, I was curious what she was going to look like. And she was extremely slender, you know, and tall and beautiful. And, you know, I said to somebody after the reading, they said, "Well, why did she feel that way?" And I said, "All girls feel that way. All women feel that way until we get to the point where we don't give a damn."
There are many possible things that can hobble someone's creativity. It might be something that's external, like distractions. It might be something internal, like a lack of confidence or fatigue. Or it could have something to do with skills, not feeling that you're, you know, up to snuff, for example, you know, technology-based, or you don't have the information that you need. One thing that often, especially for kids or for adults too, is scrutiny. Nobody likes it when someone's sort of staring over their shoulders.
That's what the internal critic is all about. It's all about we should all think the same. We should all fit into this box. And if you step out of that, you're not safe. Things are unpredictable. And that is where the best writing and the best art comes from. So with my students, you know, with kids, they'll write 5 poems over 4 or 5 weeks, and then I'll ask them to choose the one they like the best, and that's the one we'll work on. We'll take to another draft. 9 times out of 10, those students will choose the weakest piece of writing. It's the piece where they've taken the least amount of chance. They feel like they're coloring within the lines. And that is not what makes good literature or good art.
Another issue that often comes up with creative effort is impatience. people think, you know, I'm going to get started and it's going to come out and it's going to be beautiful and I'll be done in 15 minutes. Well, maybe 20 or maybe a half an hour. And then it takes longer and longer and longer. And sometimes they give it up because they're so impatient and they've come to a point where they think, I can't take this amount of time. I can't take this amount of effort.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. I'm Suki Wessling of the Babelry. I talk to women from all walks of life about the confusion of our modern Tower of Babel. We're speaking with Joanne Foster and Patrice Vecchione about creativity. We talked about what creativity is and what forces in our lives might stifle creativity. But here's the most important question. We all face barriers to practicing our creativity. So when we face a barrier, how do we get around it? Not surprisingly, creative people can offer a lot of creative solutions to get around blocks. Here's Joanne, whose book, Ignite Your Ideas, offers teachers and parents guidance on stoking creativity in children.
A lot of things take time. It took Edison how long to create a light bulb? I mean, really. We need to just be patient with ourselves and consider the experiences along the way rather than that final endpoint. And also finding sometimes if you just need to move or need music or you need something to sort of fuel you along the way as you do work more creatively. And pep talks can be helpful as well, pep talks from others or pep talks that you give to yourself.
Patrice has written inspiring books that focus on helping writers find and express their inner voices. In her book, Step Into Nature, for example, she offers writers ways to find their inspiration outside.
In all three of my nonfiction books, I address what I refer to as the internal critic. And for most people, for everybody, the critic isn't internal initially. Initially, the critic is external, and then it's internalized. And I encounter that with every age group. Well, except really young children. Kindergartners and first graders, for the most part, don't exhibit a sense of the internal critic. So when I got the contract in 1999 to write my book, Writing in the Spiritual Life, I got a check and I spent the money, and then I had to write the book. And I spent quite a bit of time in bed, unable to do anything, terrified because of the internal critic. So for me, that was given to me predominantly by my father and to some degree by my mother. So what I did when I finally got out of bed is I asked myself, well, who are you? Who is this critic? And I created a character. So then you can externalize what has been internalized so that then you gain power over that which is limiting your creativity.
Joanne really breaks down the barriers to creativity in her research.
Two other issues are complexity and simplicity. Sometimes things are just so complex that can be daunting. So finding the way to manage it, to find it, two things in chunks or manageable bits. And if something is too simplistic that, you know, well, this is not interesting to me because it's just not stimulating enough. It's too easy. I'm just going to tune myself out. Distractions can hobble creativity. We get started on doing something and then a million other things get in the way. So you veer off course or you lose your focus, and distractions come in all sizes. Like, they could be potato chips, it could be a doorbell, it could be whatever interrupts or derails creativity. So learning what distracts you and trying to manage those or eliminate them in some way and working on paying attention to those distractions.
If we think about back in the days of kingdoms, so it seems like we may be in a day of kingdoms now, but if we look back historically, there was the jester and there was the fool is the jester, and that person could say things to the king or queen that they would not accept coming from one of their advisors. And they could do that because they were the fool, they weren't taken seriously, but they had a quality of, they were outsiders. And I think that the creative person is in a lot of ways an outsider.
Little or no progress is another thing that can derail or hobble creativity. Sometimes it just takes one little thing that makes you feel wonderful as you proceed that can provide the momentum to keep you going. And perceived risk. If something is scary and you don't think that you want to undertake it, then that could mean that you're not going to be creative around it either. So, you know, learning to assess how important is it to me to hurdle that obstacle or get past that fear, what kind of guidance or assistance or strategies might come in handy if I want to be creative in this way. And you know, I mean, you don't want to do anything dangerous, but you do want to show that you can push yourself and extend.
Modern life itself presents new barriers to creativity that people in the past didn't have to deal with. When you talk to most people today, the first thing you hear is how busy they are. It might lead you to wonder, are we really so much busier than we used to be? Actually, yes, but not in the way you might think. In the past, being busy often meant being at work, having a full social life, or doing lots of volunteer work. But today we have the added overhead of an onslaught of information that constantly distracts us and fills our conscious thought with events beyond our control. Patrice talks about how she was so focused on world events at one point that she stopped all her creative work.
One thing that happened for me, it was the anxiety that I was living in for a few months, and I gave up my joy. And joy is a creative act. And if we succumb to despair, we are going to be unable to find solutions to problems. Solving problems, whether they're mathematical problems or cultural or societal political problems, is a deeply creative act.
Joanne and Patrice say that as schools and teachers are pressured to conform more and more to standards, there's less room in the classroom for creativity. Here, Patrice recounts the change that she's seen in young children's access to imagination.
I was working with a second grade class, and I said, okay, come on, let's lie down on the asphalt and look up at the clouds. And this is something I have done with students for 30 years. We lie down, we look up, and I ask the children, what do you see? And they look at each other like, I'm nutty. They roll their eyes. And finally, one kid is daring, and he says, Miss Patrice, we see the clouds. And I said, well, don't you see the man with the bouquet of balloons running ahead of the dragon? So the more that we rely on devices and less on ourselves and reading and art, it does diminish creativity. And so I have seen that over the years in young children.
Joanne points out that without the support of adults in their lives, children don't develop their creative urges as much.
I think there are a lot of ways in which parents and teachers can encourage children's creativity, and those translate into ways in which adults can encourage their own creativity. And that, mm-hmm. that has to do with having a desire, that choice that I mentioned before, having supportive others around you, someone who will give you that encouragement and tell you, yeah, I'll do that. I'll do those pushes for you.
Joanne and Patrice may come at the question of creativity from two sides, but where they intersect is in the joy of creativity and the conviction that if all of us pursued our creativity, even in times of stress, and maybe especially in times of stress, humanity would be all the better for it.
Get to know yourself and how to tune out the things that are causing you stress. Look for those outlets that maybe will enable you to feel more positive. Whatever it is that will help you find that way forward and build your own momentum and empower your creativity. Find a way through. Find the supports that you need in order to extend what matters in your life, what matters to you in your life or to your family. Believe in yourself. Believe in yourself.
I think we have to look at what does the experience of making art and writing give us? What do we get from that encounter? I do see it as an encounter. And it's another way in which creativity to me is mysterious, because it's an encounter with ourselves, but it's also an encounter with what Jung called the collective unconscious. So something happens in the creative process, one of exploration, one of curiosity, one of unpredictability. Look, let me put it to you this way. When I was young, by the time I was 20, I had done almost every drug that was available. And when doing all of those drugs, I was always after the same thing. And I was after the experience of ecstasy. I was after the experience of feeling one with the universe and being beyond myself. Just like in that little bear story that many of us read to children, I realized I didn't need the fur hat, and I didn't need the mittens, and I didn't need the scarf. All I needed was myself and a pen and a piece of paper. So what happens for me when I create, whether it's with a needle and thread or a pen and paper, is I experience a level of joy and ecstasy that I have only experienced in the best sex and the best feeling in love and moments in nature. So I think that experience is the domain of everyone. And everyone has the potential to experience that sense of ecstasy through creative expression. Now, sometimes writing is hard. I mean, making art is terrifying. There's no doubt about it. You can encounter things in the creative process that are difficult to face, and it makes us nervous. It makes us want to turn away. Yes, that's some of it, but also the experience of going beyond what you know. I always tell students, you know more than you know you know. You know?
I do.
We do. We all do. Yes.
That's it for Sprouts. I'm Suki Wessling of The Babblery. You can find full episodes and show notes at babblery.com. Special thanks to Joanne Foster and Patrice Vecchione for sharing their creativity with us. The song Ragu is courtesy of Rose Azerti. The Babblery is produced with support from K-Squid. That's KSQD Community Radio at ksqd.org. Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Suki Wessling in beautiful Santa Cruz, California. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts. Good morning.
Hey, folks, you're listening to X-Ray FM. Welcome to the Commons. We're your hosts, Hannah Francis
and Julia Moore. The views and opinions expressed during the X-Ray AM morning show belong to us, the hosts, and do not represent the official policies or positions of X-Ray FM.
Any content provided by the DJs and commentators are not intended to offend any specific demographic, including religious groups, ethnic and cultural identities, club, organization, company, or individuals.
And what up, guys? You can text into the station, and we might read it on air. That text line is 971-220-5979. So if you got thoughts, you got opinions, you want to send them our way, that's 971-220-5979.
And stay tuned. We got a cool show coming up. We've got an interview later with Garlin from Oregon Co-op Housing, or a Oregon Co-op Housing group. And then we also have some updates about the Portland No Kings protest and the Olympia No Kings protest, mm-hmm. and some recent city decisions, such as, putting the sanctuary city encoded into the Portland, what do you call that? The Portland, code.
Oh, yeah, they put it into code, yeah.
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 They codified it.
They codified it.
It's cool.
Yep.
So stay tuned. It's going to be fun. We also have some local music shows coming up. But first, for this next little time up until 8 o'clock, we've got our weekly Hearts Beat segment is back. So excited to have that. That is folks from PCC bringing the arts to the people. You got any morning advice for the people?
Yeah. I always do. drink water, folks. Take care of your bodies is always a good idea. I think we work pretty hard and we're all trying to, you know, keep our heads above water. And sometimes we forget about our bodies. So,
and put the water in your head.
yes. Drink it. It's good for you. Eat some food. Remember to rest and that you deserve rest. So much love to you all.
Oh, that's nice. Same. Also, watch out, it's cold, it's like suddenly become very dark fall, and it's 45 degrees out. We're gonna get a high of 61 with a little bit of sunshine later. Later on in the week, well, it's gonna be about the same as that for the next like 3 days, and then later on in the week around Friday through next Monday, it says we're supposed to get a lot of rain. And it's going to get cold. We're going to have a high of 52 on Sunday.
Yeah, so keep, you know, you can keep rubbing your hands together, generate some friction between your palms.
Yeah,
stay warm.
Yeah.
And
it sounds like that.
And these leaves are swirling through the air, which is pretty cool. I've noticed a lot of leaves just like dancing through the air, and I think that's pretty cool.
It is nice. It makes you kind of want to dance.
Yep.
All right, stay tuned, folks. Hope you're having a cozy morning out there and dancing a little bit, getting the body moving. Here is Hearts Beat. We will be right back after that.
How has the writer's house been for both of you so far?
Oh, wow. I think I'm sold. Like, you know what? I love this place. I think I'll move here. Like, yeah. And I just quickly texted my partner. I was like, I think I'm moving here because, like, the trees, there are trees everywhere. So I love that.
There's a kind of quiet here that lends itself to, like, focus.
Yeah.
And I feel like coming from LA, like, living sort of close to downtown, I'm so used to, like, all this noise and, like, blood pressure is up, heart rate is up. But here I'm like, oh, I can, like, exhale.
I moved here from California, so I used to live in Koreatown.
Yep,
very close.
You know the T. Yeah.
And how did you guys land where you landed?
LA is funny for me because LA was the first place that my family moved to when we moved to the US, because my dad was finishing some degree there. But we lived in LA for like a few months, and then he got a job in Oklahoma, so we moved east and then got a job in Virginia. Culturally, I feel at home there. Weather-wise, I feel at home there. And a bunch of my friends from, like, different parts of the world have just moved there, kind of. So it's, like, finding community has felt easier Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like there's a lot of really great outlets for writers and creatives who just want to connect. How about you?
I was born, raised, lived most of my life in Ghana. Mm-hmm. I mean, technically, I moved to the U.S. like about less than 3 years.
Yeah.
But before then, I had done my undergrad and done like grad school in Ghana. Mm-hmm. Then came here, did grad school, mm-hmm. likely MFA mm-hmm. in creative writing. Then now I'm doing the PhD in health communication. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I think for me, it's really writing mm-hmm. that brought me here.
That's true.
Yeah. The year I applied, I had no plan of applying.
It's funny, my journey to writing is kind of similar. I remember the day I was like the good immigrant child that I was. Mm-hmm. I was going to do a sensible degree.
Yeah.
I started off doing business, mm-hmm. business management.
Yeah.
And then it was like my sophomore year of college. I was sitting in like a stats course. I'm like, I hate this. Great lecture.
Yeah.
I was sitting with like two of like my college friends who were also doing business, and they enjoyed what I did. Like, I dropped the class during the lecture, and mm-hmm. I changed my major during that lecture.
Wow.
And it was crazy. I didn't tell my parents. Until the semester before graduation, I didn't tell them.
Wow.
It was some tea. But I feel like I was able to get around it because I told them, oh, you know what? I'm going to be a professor. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And that like made it lessened the like blow. Mm-hmm. But it was similar. I was just like, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm tired of living for someone else's mm-hmm. truth mm-hmm. when like I know I'm good at this and I like doing this. It was literally like in that moment, I was like, no, I'd rather be writing.
Yeah.
And I was lucky because my undergrad had a really good poetry program. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like Rita Dove was teaching there. Uh-huh. And like my 19-year-old self was like, dear Professor Dove, I'm an aspiring da da da. And she met with me.
Wow.
I wasn't even her like student. She met with me and like she told me some books to buy, and like eventually I took her class like when I was like a junior or like senior. But having people like that and having mm-hmm. black professors, mm-hmm. having black writing professors mm-hmm, mm-hmm. showed me that it was possible.
I think for me it was slightly different. Mm-hmm. It was partly that, mm-hmm. but also I loved the work that I was doing in health, public health. Mm-hmm. I loved the ideas of public health mm-hmm. because I felt like the same thing that I was exploring in my work in public health mm-hmm. is the same thing that I explore in my work in creative writing. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I was in an undergrad class and I was writing my poems. Mm-hmm. And so some of my colleagues knew.
Right.
And I remember...
Like writing poems like during class.
Yeah.
Instead of taking notes.
Yeah, I will be writing poems uh-huh. during class. One of my friends, he actually lives in California now.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
We were exchanging notes. Mm-hmm. On paper, mm-hmm. like, and then he was like, bro, maybe you're not in the right place.
He's like, we can all see you. Yeah, we can all see you writing something.
You know,
else.
Maybe yeah. you should be at, like, because my school was, like, solely a health university.
Yeah.
Or the University of Health and Allied Sciences. Yeah. So everything was about health.
Yeah.
Right. And actually, the truth is that what I wanted to do was to write a poetry collection uh-huh. about health. Mm-hmm. Currently my PhD dissertation mm-hmm. actually does part of that work that I wanted to do as an undergrad.
Right.
So I'm working with some archives and mm-hmm. Some of the things that I'm doing now mm-hmm. are more concerned with black health mm-hmm. and especially medical mistrust, mm-hmm. Syphilis in the Negro male mm-hmm. and which often people refer to as the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, mm-hmm. which is also a very wrong title because it takes the burden off the U.S. Public Health Service or the right. government
away from
and then
that.
Puts it on the people of Tuskegee.
Yeah.
You know, and so some of the work that I'm trying to do now is to, you know, write poems about that right. using archival materials.
It's really clear in your writing mm-hmm. that you're discussing how this culture of distrust mm-hmm. this like really really mm. relevant culture mm. of distrust mm. and
and that was the main thing of yeah. the study yeah. we are waiting to see how syphilis turns out in these men if yeah. we don't treat them. We forget that some of these men were married
yeah
and so their wives oh, some so of their wives about 40 of their wives mm-hmm. were infected
mm-hmm. and then children
and then the children yeah. that they had. Some, I think about 19 kids mm. had congenital syphilis. Mm.
later on some of my work is going to explore that aspect. It's a complicated history, but yeah. I think it's also important that we still have these conversations, mm-hmm. because I think, especially considering where we are in the U.S., you know, political system right now, the yeah. history is being erased and yeah. all of that. It is very important that we don't forget about these things.
Exactly.
It is very important that, like, we keep talking about them.
And I like the fact that your work is tying poetry into it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's like a medium that can reach a whole new audience.
Yeah.
Because
it's like the more artistic mediums we have to mm-hmm. sort of proliferate in like a issue, right? Mm-hmm. The more audience we can get,
yeah.
Hopefully, the more minds we can change mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How is the archival material that you're reading making it into your work right now in your poems? Mm.
For some of them, I'm looking at, say, reports,
mm-hmm.
and I'm trying to see how I can use like Blackout or Erasure as a poem
mm-hmm.
to kind of like reveal mm-hmm. what else I am seeing in these reports.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that's one of the things. And then the other part is also trying to use Cento.
Mm,
like but that. I'm thinking yeah. of Cento as a collaborative work.
Cento form, when you a poem comprised, usually it's like the end words of different previous poems,
yeah.
but like think of it like as a collage or mosaic of like yeah. existing work
existing
that
work.
You pull together.
Yeah, and so I'm looking at it from a perspective that is multiple voices, multiple
yeah.
people,
yeah,
different people speaking
right. yeah.
in the same work. And I mean, I'm thinking about it because like in Black communities, like we are also very like communal,
yeah,
right. And so I'm like, this is what it means.
Yeah.
So this is what this person says. This is what that person says.
Yeah.
Like, why don't we bring it together?
Like, yeah. Especially within like Black expressive culture,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Black religious culture.
Yeah.
There is an inherent polyvocality.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is an inherent call in
mm-hmm.
a response.
Yeah.
When you have something as nefarious as colonization
mm-hmm.
or enslavement,
mm-hmm.
you remove a link
yeah.
from ancestry.
Yeah.
The story
is gone.
Is gone completely.
It's gone.
So
completely.
I feel like my work is in a similar vein.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'm trying to resurrect something. But also just like, it's not just resurrection. Like there's mm-hmm. like there's a resurrection and there's also like a transformation.
Yeah.
It's like I'm calling back to the past through the present to imagine like
Santo
what
far, so
yeah. yeah. to imagine what a future can look like.
How does the role of joy and music and dance
yeah.
factor into your poetry?
I appreciate that question. One of our mutual friends, Akos,
yeah.
she said this line like 5 years ago that still sits with me today.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, people think that joy and despair are opposites, right?
Yeah.
But she's like, oh, it's just, it's the same, it's on the continuum,
mm-hmm.
right? Like there are emotions on like this like, continuum of
yeah.
like self actualization,
mm-hmm.
right? So for me, it's like when I was writing Saltwater, I was in the midst of despair,
mm-hmm.
you know, like I was writing about Black Death,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is something that Black writers, debut authors,
mm-hmm.
most first books deal with death,
yeah,
in ways that it's like a social expectation,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'll circle back to that. So I was writing about death in ways that for me were cathartic because
mm-hmm.
this was like pre-George Floyd, but like post-Trayvon,
mm-hmm.
post so many other like
yeah.
public lynchings. And I had experienced it in my own life,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I had been pulled over, like I was protesting, da, 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 da. So I was like, I'm using the poetry as a way of calling out,
mm-hmm.
right? But also of like the times that I couldn't speak,
mm-hmm.
the times where I felt silence. I'm
yeah.
like, oh, y'all finna hear it in this work. But it gets to a point where it's like, oh my goodness, like it's getting a little too dark,
mm-hmm.
right? But then to resurrect or to rescue myself from that place, I look to how our funerals are,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
We dance at funerals.
Yeah.
So like there's a way that
we have fun,
right? And, like there's so many memes, it's like, oh, Black people 10 minutes after burying you, like there's people like then jamming, you know?
I mean, low-key, I think funerals are like sometimes more fun than weddings.
Yeah.
High key,
depending, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for me, it's like the joy was like, it wasn't just a balance. For me, it was like, if I'm planting the despair, the goal is to get to a place of joy.
Mm-hmm.
And it also humanizes Black experience.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's a way that people, Black joy is usually situated we are so sad, therefore we must dance, mm-hmm. right? But I'm like, no, mm-hmm. it's like, it's a human thing. You experience sadness, you experience mm-hmm. joy, you experience so many things.
Yeah.
And it's not just as simple as like, because of my trauma, mm-hmm. I must therefore be happy, yeah. right? Because I feel like people heal in so many different ways, mm-hmm. right? And like, for me, joy is a vehicle towards healing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always mean that you've healed through something, mm-hmm. but it's a vehicle towards healing. There's a kind of mourning mm-hmm. called melancholic mourning,
yeah.
right? And then there's a different kind of mourning that's like more Victorian. Mm-hmm. It's called heroic mourning. Mm-hmm. And like in the older sort of like British tradition,
yeah.
elegies were very formal. It's like you mourn this way after, at the end of the poem, release, right? Mm-hmm. But in the melancholic or in the blues mode, it's like, no, we're going to sit in this, right? Like,
yeah.
like by the end of this poem, like it doesn't mean that I've achieved closure,
mm-hmm.
right? And people think about the blues as like, oh, we sing because we are sad, and after the end of the song, everybody's happy. You know, it's like what we were saying earlier, it's bearing witness.
Yeah.
I was curious, because listening to both of you read, you're mm-hmm. both talking about a lot of spiritual themes.
Yeah.
And then it seems like you diverge in terms of like your religious backgrounds, perhaps. What? Is that true or?
Yeah, no, I love this question. Both my parents are preachers. So it's like my therapist making so much money.
Because Teddy, you're talking about the Bible a lot more.
I do talk about the Bible a lot more.
I think that, well, my initial poetry was very like religious, like, but now, yes, like in the sense of like a Negro spiritual,
mm-hmm.
as in like this faith will save us. Now I'm like, I'm very irreverent because like, and that's coming from my background as like Black Studies,
mm-hmm.
which I think for me, we're both working in Black Studies, but in mm-hmm. different realms.
Of yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the more I learn about the histories mm-hmm. of conversion,
yeah,
the more I question religion or Christianity
mm-hmm.
as a religion. And I see it more as a means to a colonial end.
Yeah.
When I'm thinking about Black music and like Black spirituality, right, like drumming,
mm-hmm.
right, which is a staple of so many Black churches, was illegal
mm-hmm.
in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, I was like about this.
Jamaica, Barbados, after the Stonewall Rebellion, 1831, here in the U.S., Black people couldn't drum. Black churches couldn't have drums for a long yeah. time, right? But when drums come back, I'm like, drumming is the quintessential Afro-spiritual medium,
mm-hmm.
right? Even like in the new book that I'm writing, it's dedicated or it centers on the Yoruba Orisha Ayo,
mm-hmm.
which is the Orisha of wood
mm-hmm.
and drumming, right? Because I'm Yoruba on my dad's side. And the Yoruba believe that a drum will only repeat the sounds that it's heard,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's certain trees that are sacred to drums. Like these trees are only harvested for drums. When you harvest the tree, the last step in the drum making process, you leave the tree in different parts of the community to hear the sound of the language, so that when it's time for the gods to speak, they'll be able to speak in the language that people understand, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's this way that like drumming is so innately African, and drums were used as forms of communication in the Western Hemisphere, that once colonizers understood this,
mm-hmm.
drumming is banned. I would be so much more open to a kind of Christianity that is syncretic,
mm-hmm.
and that appreciates the legacies of African spirituality,
mm-hmm.
right? But there's ways that the way that we were colonized, it demonizes anything
yeah.
that is inherently African.
This country has tried so much
mm-hmm.
for Black people in this country to not even get any education.
Mm-hmm.
Right. For us to be able to resist, to be able to write, to read,
mm-hmm.
to recite,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, speak up about some of these things in poetry,
mm-hmm.
right? That alone is resistant. One of the poems that I read, there's a line in it that my mom used to say.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, if you don't know how to fight,
mm-hmm.
sing the praise
mm-hmm.
of those who fight.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so in this moment, one of the
mm-hmm.
things that we can do is, if you cannot fight in
mm-hmm.
this moment,
mm-hmm.
you can sing.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM.
K296 FT West Haven, serving Portland at 107.1 FM. And K219 KU Nehalem, serving Nehalem, Wheeler, Manzanita, and Rockaway Beach at 91.7 FM.
We are streaming live and archived at xray.fm, where radio is yours. Good morning, Portland.
And welcome back to The Commons, your Monday morning radio guide to news, culture, and local action.
Start your week informed with stories that matter to you and your neighbors, spotlighting people and events, shaping Portland's future environmentally, socially, and economically.
With a focus on direct action, union organizing, and the thriving local art scene, we're here to help you play the cards in your hand and make a difference.
Whether you're tuning in for the news, the music, or the opportunity to act,
The Commons is where Portland gathers. We're your hosts. I'm Hannah Francis.
And I'm Julia Moore. It is 7:59. We're counting down to the 8 o'clock on Monday, October 20th.
Yes, we are.